We're going to go ahead and get started. I'd like everyone to please come. And those of you who are along the wall, please feel free to fill in here along this open square. It'll make for a better event, I think, in participation and the like.
We won't call on you with a pop quiz, promise.
Thank you all for being with us this morning. We have a lot of material to cover. I'm Steve Morrison from CSIS. I direct the Africa program and also direct the HIV/AIDS Task Force, which has now been in existence for 6 years. We launched this back in November 2011. We decided that we wanted to organize this event for a couple of reasons. One is World AIDS Day, and while that falls on the weekend, we wanted to have an event here today because of the increased attention. And secondly, because of the importance and the quality of the work that's been generated by the team of people that are here today that I'll be introducing momentarily, who've done such terrific work on Russia, India, and China. We've issued these reports. We wish you to take away hard copies and access them on the electronic form. These are three terribly important countries, and the folks who've been working these issues on the CSIS side have been working them for some time. And I think that we're very proud of the fact that we've acquired over the last 6 years such a strong record and depth of engagement on these matters, and it's reflected in the quality of the reports that they've all put forward. These reports were meant to be they're part of a broader series of reports that we've issued this year as we enter the reauthorization debate around PEPFAR. In this case, these are countries that back in 2002 in particular that the task force decided these are large, populous, powerful countries that are at some risk of a generalized epidemic. They're ones that have large sway globally and within their regions, depth and expertise, difficult and complex bilateral relationships with the United States. And at that period, in the 2002 period, when we really began engaging, there was great uncertainty around where were their policies going to go. Now, as we thought about this, about trying to structure this event today, we thought, well, let's try to make this much more interactive than sort of stovepiped presentations, and let's try to cut across a couple of different planes of issues, and let's try to be reflective of some of the surprises and lessons learned, what caught us off guard looking back over the last several years, and what's been points of continuity, because many of the assumptions that were operative just a few years ago around how rigid or unforgiving were these governments in terms of policy, which direction was the epidemic going, how fruitful would the U.S. collaboration with these particular governments be on HIV/AIDS. A lot of those assumptions that we started from turned out needed to be modified significantly. And so what we're going to do here today is begin, and we're going to segment this in the discussion into sort of three planes. The first is going to be with respect to the epidemic itself. And we're going to ask representatives of the three papers to give us a sort of quick entry point into, okay, looking back on the epidemic and the trend lines, what do we say today? And how does what we say today differ from what we were carrying in our heads a short while back? And what does this mean for the future? And we're gonna ask all three to sort of weigh in rapidly, and then we want to have a sort of interactive exchange and call upon you for some input, comments, and questions. And then we're going to move from there to the question of policy of these governments. And we'll have our second plane, our second segment, and we'll sort of repeat that process. And I'll sort of call the first to a halt, and we'll move to the second, The third is really the question around U.S. engagement. And this the nature of the relationships that we have in these countries is fundamentally different from what exists among the focus countries of PEPFAR. And they take a different form. They have a different set of emphases. They operate within a different, more strategic and dense kind of bilateral relationship. And that'll be the third segment. We're joined here today also. We're very proud that we're joined and delighted that we're joined by a delegation of Chinese NGOs who are with us. Chao Qing will introduce them in a moment. Welcome, and thank you so much for being with us. Each of these papers involved an effort by both the directors of the programs, Tezi Schaefer, Andy Cutchins, Charles Freeman from the South Asia, Russia, and China programs, respectively, as well as input from experts that we brought in to help us. In this case, Judy Twigg, who's now a senior associate with CSIS and a senior faculty member and associate professor at the Douglas Wilder School of Government at Virginia Commonwealth University, who is a renowned American expert on Russia health policy, kindly agreed to be the lead author on the Russia paper. Vibhuti Hatte from the South Asia program played a lead role in doing a lot of research and writing on the India paper. Chao Qing Lu from the China program, both Vibhuti and Chao Qing are research associates with CSIS and have been here with us for a 2-3 year period and have contributed enormously to this. I'm not sure that we need long introductions for Tezi and for Charles. Tezi has been with CSIS heading the South Asia program for the last 9 years. She's a retired senior foreign service officer with a very distinguished career in South Asia at the ambassadorial, at the deputy assistant secretary level. She is particularly expert on matters pertaining to the subcontinent, to India, to Pakistan, and to Sri Lanka. Charles Freeman has joined us recently as the new Freeman Chair in China Studies, comes to us with a very long career on trade and finance background as an assistant director of USTR in the Bush administration, with lead responsibilities on negotiating relations with China. He also served as part of the China Alliance, a group of lawyers, law firms that helped clients devise their trade approaches to China. Andrew Cutchins is the senior fellow and director of the CSIS Russia and Eurasia program from 2000 to 2006. He was a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he directed its Russia and Eurasia program in Washington, D.C., 2000-2003, and then the Moscow program afterwards. What I'd like to do is ask all of our speakers to talk into the microphones so that we are so that your words will be captured for the purposes of the video stream that we're putting together here. What I'd like to do is ask Tezi to sort of kick us off with the sort of quick comments on sort of what do we see and know with respect to the epidemic, what surprised us, what's been continuous, looking forward. Then we'll come to Judy, and then we'll come to Chao Qing, and then we'll use this first 20, 25 minutes in that respect, and then we'll move on to the policy. So thank you all for joining. Thank you all for all the effort you've put into these terrific papers. Tezi, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Steve. And it's nice to see so many friends in the audience. I do want to add one thing to your tributes to those who have contributed to this, and that is to mention Vibhuti's predecessor, Pramit Mitra, who did the first draft and who was really the backbone of our work on this until he left us to go get an MBA at Yale. So I hope he is with us in spirit from New Haven. The big story in India, of course, as it is in so many places, is the new numbers. And the new numbers in India, as in other places and around the world,
look a lot lower than the old ones. This doesn't really represent a changed trend. It represents a changed way of estimating the numbers. But the end result is that you have a current estimate of the number of infected people in India that's on the order of 3 million instead of approximately between 5 and 6. In other respects, however, the new numbers really don't change our understanding of the dynamics of the epidemic. It is most pronounced in 4 large southern states and 2 tiny northeastern ones. It is spread primarily through intravenous drug use in the 2 tiny northeastern states, primarily through sexual encounters in the 4 large southern states. The vectors that people worry about are substantially the same, sex workers, migrant workers, and the spouses at home of those who get infected when they are going around the country in search of work. One interesting feature of the new numbers is that apart from a shift in methodology that provides better measurement of the general population, they are also based on a steadily expanding network of surveillance sites. And I think this is tremendously important because you now have a surveillance site in nearly every district in India. This is a technical term. There are 1,000 of them. The government had started by focusing mainly on the states where it knew it had a problem. What this means is that we are likely over the next 4 or 5 years to get a much better fix on whether the low prevalence states are actually low prevalence or whether they're just undermeasured. And perhaps even more important than that is the fact that the government will have a much better basis for deploying its resources. I'll stop there because we were going to talk mainly about the big picture at this stage, but Vibhuti did have some insights from her travels. So,
do you want to add those right now?
Whatever you prefer.
Yeah, go right ahead.
Okay. During my recent trip to India, there were a couple of ideas that emerged from conversations with NGOs and government officials. The first was how impressed everyone is with how fast the National AIDS Control Organization, NACO, is moving. Everyone seems to be on board with the direction that NACO's leadership is going in, particularly with the new phase of the National AIDS Control Program, NACP3. There's a general feeling that the national plan is very comprehensive and is appropriately focused for India's epidemic. Moreover, NACP3 is one of the first steps towards mainstreaming the delivery of HIV prevention, treatment, and care services through the existing public health infrastructure. There are initiatives in place that will help the national program piggyback on a lot of the existing infrastructure. There's some concern.
What you wanted to talk about, I think, was the reaction to the new numbers.
Right. I think people are, well, they were at the same, okay. I think that people are, on the one hand, they're not too concerned with the new numbers because they feel that this distribution and the trends are the same. And what they mean by that is the states that were high prevalence states are still the states that have come out in the new numbers. If they suddenly the new numbers had said that you don't need to worry about AP, I think that would have been cause for concern. They feel the new numbers have validated their geographic focus. On the other hand, they feel that what they don't want to happen is for the government to say, oh, well, the new numbers are lower. Maybe we don't need to put funding into these districts. Maybe we can change funding and put it into something else. And they're hoping that that doesn't happen. But at this point, it's too early to say what the impact will be on the ground of the new numbers.
I mean, we can get into this into the discussion, but it seems to me, I mean, India was the most vociferous earlier in the decade in criticizing the methodologies that were generating the numbers. They fought them the most vociferously. It set off a debate around are these valid critiques or are these critiques that are being used in order to dampen the number, you know, keep the numbers down for political purposes. In retrospect now, I mean, these adjustments that have happened would seem to validate all of those earlier arguments in an interesting way. It does have implications in terms of what does it mean, what does it communicate psychologically or politically around the prevention threat or the need for continued, very concerted, intensive prevention efforts. It also puts the focus even more overwhelmingly back upon Africa, which is a sort of implicit shift that happens. But in the broader debates that happen between the Indians and the Indian government and others within India and outside India around what are the valid numbers, these new numbers really are a very important sort of addition to the debate. Maybe we can get back to that.
And interestingly, everyone feels, and this is NGOs and government officials, both feel very comfortable now going forward with a new methodology. And they feel what were guesstimates in the past are now backed by more solid data.
So looking back, the investment that's been made in the creation of these new sentinel sites and better methodology is now accepted, and it's now the numbers. There's not a debate that's come forward about, well, we need to further fight about that. There's a general consensus that these numbers are better and stronger. Is that correct?
Or at least the best we can get at the moment, and quite scary enough for the professionals to take the epidemic seriously. We'll see whether they have political fallout, which is more problematic.
All right. Judy, would you like to?
Sure. Russia has not been mentioned prominently in the discussion about the new numbers globally that has taken place over the last couple of weeks, but UNAIDS has released a new estimate of the number of cases of HIV in Russia, and that number is around 900,000 cases. And to give you an indication of the degree to which that number is controversial, the country's chief epidemiologist and the head of the country's federal HIV/AIDS center seem to be engaging this week in a very public battle over the attitude toward that 900,000 figure. With one saying that UNAIDS is insulting Russia by publishing a number that's this high, that in fact Russia has the epidemic far more under control than that, and that number is a gross exaggeration, and yet the head of the Federal AIDS Center saying, no, the truth is probably closer to 1.1 or 1.2 million. So the real numbers in Russia have been a matter of great uncertainty since the late 90s when the epidemic really began to take off, and that remains the case today. Largely because the country still is very much in its infancy in terms of understanding what sentinel surveillance is, how it would construct the kind of surveillance sites that seem to be successfully implemented in India. Russia still does mass screenings that tend to target the people who are least likely to become infected with HIV. The official count, the Russian government's official statement of the number of cases is about 405,000 as of today. Now, if you go back to the end of the 1990s, the trajectory that the epidemic took, say, through 1997 through 1999, 2000, 2001, was explosive. Russia was had the fastest growing rate of HIV infection in the world at that point. And many of the projections that we heard at that time, 4, 5, 6 years ago, were talking about a number of cases in the millions by the time you got till today. And yet what you saw was that annual incidence, according to the officially reported numbers, actually declined between 2001 and 2005. And there were many explanations for this at the time, some of them having to do with the poor surveillance structure and the fact that there were many cases that were just hidden from these officially reported statistics, but also some speculation that perhaps the injection drug user population had simply been saturated with HIV, we're just at the beginning of a more generalized epidemic, many questions surrounding the epidemic during this time period. Now, even the official numbers show that over the last 2 years, there has been something like a 7 to 10% increase in annual incidence. And so clearly the number of new cases is going up. And no one contests the idea that the number of new cases, the rise in the number of new cases is disproportionately female. And many people are pointing to this fact as an indication that the epidemic is generalizing out from the injection drug user population into the general population through heterosexual contact. When you talk to the people who are actually on the ground working with clients of harm reduction, working with the pregnant women who are testing positive for HIV, you get a slightly different story, which is that, yes, there are more women testing positive, but those women are still connected primarily to the injection drug use driven epidemic. In other words, those women are either drug users themselves or they are the direct sexual partners of current or former injection drug users. And quite frankly, we still just don't have the research that we need on the sexual mixing patterns that are taking place in Russia to fully understand the degree to which we can say the epidemic is generalizing across bridge populations from the injection drug use population. And so I would end with a statement that certainly the epidemic has surprised us in that it did not continue to explode along the trajectory that we saw in the late 1990s, and yet we're still left with many of the fundamental questions about the nature of the epidemic today that we had 2 or 3 or 4 years ago.
Can you offer any further comment? I mean, there's in 2002 when the NIC report came out, it included some pretty dire projections that caused around where the epidemic was going to be moving, and both with respect to Russia as well as India and China.
First of all, I think that in view of the differences in methodology between the old way of counting and the new way of counting in India, I don't think we can actually say very much about trends because we know what the trends were when you stuck with the old methodology, although the number of surveillance sites was increasing, so in a sense it wasn't a consistent pattern of measurement. We know what the new methodology has told us in 1 year. It's going to be a while before we get a better fix on trends. But this doesn't appear to be consistent with a massive, explosive epidemic. On the other hand, in a sense, the difference between a focused epidemic and a generalized one is perhaps not as great as would appear to be the case. It certainly is already the case that you are getting some HIV and AIDS spread into the general population. It is widely accepted that one of the vectors of HIV transmission is migratory labor. Guys go off on the road, and it is almost always guys, in search of work. And then at some point, they come home to their wives. And this is a bridge into the general population. In the high prevalence states, you've certainly seen this in a very pronounced fashion. I remember Steve was there almost 4 years ago when we visited a huge hospital in the city of Hyderabad, where they had a prenatal clinic that actively tried to persuade women to get tested and then tried to follow up with those who tested positive. And the state HIV/AIDS director there, who was kind of overwhelmed and desperate about the whole situation, kept saying, but people don't understand that this is already in the general population. So the question is, how widely is it in the general population? Is it still fairly close to that original high-risk group source of infection? Has it spread much beyond that? And I think this is a continuum rather than a flicking a switch type of situation.
Thank you. Chao Cheng, could you also introduce our visitor?
Sure. I want to welcome our IRI delegation of Chinese AIDS NGO members here again. The International Republican Institute has been providing capacity training, capacity building help to Chinese AIDS NGOs. Here we have members of representatives of NGO members that represent the Global Fund country coordinating mechanisms, the Global Fund CCM NGO members here. They are here for this week and next week on a capacity training tour in the United States. And I want to welcome you again and encourage the audience to have discussion with the delegation members on their experience in fighting AIDS in China. Regarding the epidemic in China, unfortunately, our report, the China paper, the data needs to be updated because the UNAIDS and the Chinese government has just released a 2007 update of the epidemic yesterday. So I will use the new data from the new report for today's presentation. The 2007 estimate is 700,000 cases, HIV cases in China, compared to the previous estimate of 650,000 cases. cases. So in 2007, we have 50,000 new cases. The officially confirmed cases is 23,000. This number is far lower than the estimated cases of 700,000, largely because of people's reluctance for HIV testing in China still. I want to touch very briefly upon the estimate, the history of the data. In 2004, the Chinese government scaled back the estimate of HIV cases to 840,000 people from the previous estimate of nearly 1 million. The government again lowered the figure to 650,000 in 2005. Experts have said that the figures were probably accurate because they were in line with a change in the way data was collected. In terms of new infection, we have 50,000 new cases this time in 2007 compared to 70,000 in 2005. So in that sense, the rate of new infection in China is actually slowing down. However, there is no room for complacency. Overall, yes, the HIV epidemic in China is still low prevalence, but we still have pockets of very high infection rate among specific subpopulation or high-risk groups, such as the injection drug users, commercial sex workers, and MSM groups. And also, the epidemic is concentrating on specific regions in China, particularly in Henan, Guangdong, Xinjiang, and Yunnan provinces. And also there are some very worrisome data in the Chinese official statistics. There is an increase in the number of heterosexual transmission. Now the sexual transmission accounts for 44.7% of the total new infection. Sexual transmission is now becoming the primary mode of transmission in China. Unsafe sex has overtaken drug use as the primary cause of new infection, and this raises new concern that the epidemic will spread from high-risk groups to the general public. Also, several emerging factors, such as the increase in China's sex trade, increasing premarital and extramarital sex, greater social tolerance for homosexuality, and the risky behavior among China's migrant workers, the floating population, could also serve as a bridge to spread the epidemic into the general population. Also, the epidemic is still dominated by injecting drug users, the IDUs. The Ministry of Public Security data shows that the number of registered drug users in China has risen steadily at a rate of about 122% per year, with the official number in 2005 was 1.16 million. However, the total number of drug users, including those unregistered, is thought to be much higher, with some estimates placing it at 3.5 million. Heroin is the most commonly used drug in China, and sharing injecting equipment is very common. So overall, the epidemic is still a very large challenge in China, and the country is still in a very critical period of time for AIDS prevention.
Thank you. Charles, did you want to add any comments?
No, I think that covers it, but I would say that like India, you've got migratory issues on the rise. You've got a lot of migratory workers that are moving about. As the disease moves into the general population, that only is going to increase it. So I do want to underscore that though the numbers look good on paper, it really is, as Xiaoqing says, it's no time for complacency.
Okay. This is a very mixed picture. I mean, the all of your accounts are sort of saying that remains concentrated. It's scaled in a different way than less than what had been anticipated, but great uncertainty still around the data. and big gaps in what we do or do not know. No reason for complacency, but in the overall picture, the problem or the threat looks considerably less in some respects than it did 5 years ago. Tessie?
Yeah, there's one piece of good news that I should have mentioned initially and neglected to, and that is that in at least one of the high prevalence states, Tamil Nadu, which was the place where the first documented HIV case in India was found, there's now increasing evidence to suggest that the epidemic is slowing down. There are some tantalizing factoids in some of the other high prevalence states, but nothing that would lead the sort of the weight of the professional opinion to reach the same conclusion about them yet. But this at least suggests that in a state with a fairly large infected population, but a fairly good government and public health infrastructure, it is possible to turn things around.
Well, all of you have talked about sort of data and not so much about behavior change, you know, as to whether or not what we're seeing is the result of changes of patterns of behavior that may tie in with sort of government interventions or policies. Let's take a few comments from the audience here and then come back to our speakers. Please use your microphone. Please quickly introduce yourselves and direct your comments to us. We'll take three quick comments, then come back. Sir, and then Harley, and then this gentleman.
Bill McGreevy at Georgetown. The real question for me, and maybe it's for you, Stephen, is what is going to be the impact of the new data on decisions about foreign assistance, particularly PEPFAR in the U.S. Congress? But actually, the evidence presented by the speakers is very consistent with what some people have been saying for several years. Helen Epstein, who spoke here a few weeks ago about the difference in concurrent sexual behavior in the areas of highest incidence and prevalence in sub-Saharan Africa, which is quite different from Asia and Europe. Perhaps some of the speakers might want to address the different perspective now on the basic causes for the or etiology of the epidemic.
Harley?
I wanted to raise a similar issue because all three speakers, thank you for your presentations, talked about the generalized epidemic and whether or not the epidemic will go from these focused high-risk groups to the general population. And the critical determining factor there is the concurrent sexual relationships. And I disagree with, is it Dr. Schaefer, Ms. Schaefer, that when you do have concurrent sexual relationships, it is like flipping a switch. I think that's largely the reason why sub-Saharan African epidemic is so much worse than the epidemic you see anywhere else. And to use your example, when that migrant worker comes home and infects his wife, that is a spread to the general population, but the critical question is whether or not she has other sexual partners. And that completely changes the forecasting of the epidemic and what the future of the epidemic looks like. And if she doesn't, and I haven't seen a lot of evidence that there are a lot of concurrent sexual networks in either Russia, India, or China, then I think we're talking about even lower potential for explosive generalized populations than has been reviewed here.
Thanks. Let's take one more comment. Sir, please identify yourself.
My name is Rajan Gupta. I'm from Los Alamos. One thing which would really help in this debate is if the analysis and the data was made public and open. Because this is not a lot of this forecasting and a lot of this uncertainty is really because the data is not made accessible to a wide class of people who could analyze it. There is transparency in a large part of the U.S. data, and most of us can go and look at the trends, and they're fairly reliable. And the same analysis could be done by a much larger body and bring transparency to the whole system. So when India does the analysis, who knows what the reliability factor is? And this issue of this modeling, this was known that there were a lot of gaps in the modeling and nobody paid attention to it, and they were able to hide it for almost 10 years because of the lack of transparency. So I think that's, if we want to really take numbers seriously and do this numbers game, then at some level, we have to move away from these issues of hidden data.
Thank you. Why don't we roll through our speakers on those questions before we move to the matter of policy. Judith, would you like to?
Sure. Quickly, on the issue of transparency, in Russia, there's total transparency in terms of the data that the government have available. If someone tests positive for HIV, that person is, in a very routine and transparent manner, reported to one of the 89 regional AIDS centers in the country, and then those data are collected by the Federal AIDS Center and are reported for wide distribution. The problem is a social and, even more importantly, I think, a legal environment that presents so many disincentives for someone to be tested and captured by those official data. So that the problem isn't one of transparency. The problem is one of this legal environment. And that leads me to the addressing of the other questions that were asked. Given everything that I indicated in my earlier remarks about the course of the epidemic, I don't think there's room for complacency precisely because there are so many disincentives for the members of the predominant risk groups to be identified as members of those risk groups and then beyond that to be tested for HIV. For example, if you're registered as an injection drug user and they have official registers of IDUs in Russia, there are all sorts of negative consequences that redound to that down the line. And so when you talk, for example, with the folks who work in the NGOs that do harm reduction in Russia, what they say is that for research purposes, largely they're working with the same pool of clients who represent a small minority of the total number of drug users. And the studies that we do just interview the same drug user over and over again to get the data. That's very frustrating. To try to tie the Russia situation into some of the other comments that have been made, there are also very important risk groups that are virtually unstudied in Russia. Men who have sex with men, you just never hear anything about in the studies of Russia. Now, clearly, this is an important risk group, and for a lot of reasons that I think are probably self-evident, that's a group that remains largely hidden. Migrant workers. There are millions of illegal migrant workers in Russia coming up from Central Asia. They're involved in the drug trafficking that is spreading the epidemic, and there's very little research that's done among those populations in terms of their risk behaviors for contracting the epidemic, and then again, what happens when they go home to their wives and return again. Even sex workers are a dramatically understudied risk group in the country. So I don't mean for a discussion of what's happening with the IDU-driven epidemic and the official figures to lure us into a false complacency. It may indeed be the case that the epidemic is winding down this current phase, but we just don't know enough about behavior patterns and about important trajectories within these risk groups to know what's likely to come next.
Thank you. Chao-Cheng, would you like to add comment on the China context?
I want to address the question on the impact of the data on foreign assistance. I think the international community has done a great deal of great work in pushing the envelope on the AIDS front. In China, it has not only in terms of funding, but also in terms of introducing the best practices and the and so forth. And I think the new data shows that there are several high-risk population. And also, I want to reiterate what Charles just mentioned, the importance of focusing on the migrant workers because they have the strong potential to become the bridge population to channel the epidemic to the general population. So I think the international assistance, the U.S. government assistance should be expanded to focus more on the at-risk, high-risk populations to increase access to testing, to prevention among migrant workers, among drug users.
Chao-Cheng, can you just comment also, that's an excellent answer, can you also comment on the question of the transparency of data and the point that Harley made around concurrent sexual relations as a driver?
The data, the estimate is a joint work between the UN AIDS and the Chinese Ministry of Health, and it is transparent to the public. And as Judy said, as the same in Russia, the issue actually in the AIDS field is not transparency, but I think there is a strong factor of discrimination and stigma, so people have the reluctance to go for the testing and counseling, and that's why we don't have the confirmed data.
In terms of concurrent sexual partners as a driver?
I don't have any.
Okay, all right.
Okay, Tessie, you get the wrap-up on this segment.
Okay. First of all, Steve mentioned behavior change. Certainly one of the factors in the apparent slowing down of the epidemic in Tamil Nadu is behavior change. What data there is, and it's not statewide, but it's fairly consistent in the areas that are higher infected than others, suggests that sex workers are using condoms in far higher numbers than they did before. And that this, at a minimum, is one of the things that is contributing to the slowdown. The issue of concurrent sexual behavior is a tough one because you're dealing with an area where you have a lot of beliefs and relatively few facts. Is it in fact true that men have lots of sexual partners and women don't? I mean, mathematically, that's kind of, the disparity can't be as great as it appears, because you start with a roughly equal population of men and women. But clearly you've got two potential sources of infection that are recognized as high-risk groups. One is migrant labor, which is overwhelmingly male. And the other is sex workers, who are predominantly female, and many of whom, in the Indian context, aren't necessarily hustling people off the streets in Calcutta or sitting in the red light district in Mumbai. They may be working out of home. So you have both male and female potential entry points. It is the working assumption of the people who follow the epidemic that the person who's on the receiving end is less likely to spread it than the person who's on the giving end. I don't think anybody has put any numbers next to that, and if they did, I seriously doubt that they would have much of a basis in fact. But net-net, you would probably have seen a bigger jump if that assumption were totally wrong. The question of transparency in India, no, detailed numbers are not released, although semi-detailed numbers are with a considerable lag. But to understand what the numbers are, think about what the surveillance system has been. And the surveillance system is still a very important input even into the new methodology numbers. Selected maternity clinics were used as a proxy for the general population. Sexually transmitted disease clinics were used as a way of measuring that high-risk population. There was supposed to be some kind of sites where the infection rate in men who have sex with men was mentioned, but everyone recognized that this was a grossly understudied population. At one time, when I looked at this a few years ago, there were four sites in the whole country of India. So if you release those numbers, and it's a floating number of actual surveillance sites, yes, you make it possible for more people to study them, but I think you have to accept the imperfection of the numbers. And you can understand why there was a collective sigh of relief among the professionals when they discovered that numbers that were generated by adding population surveys from six different states came up with roughly the same distribution pattern. I think among the professionals in India, there's very little expectation of being able to arrive at the real number. If you can get an approximation of trends and distribution, you at least have your management tool. The other interesting thing, though, and just one more sentence, what states were studied with general population surveys? It was 5 high prevalence states, all of the big ones and one of the tiny ones, and one of those that's not high prevalence. The largest state in India, the one with probably the second worst local government and public health setup. The surveillance system relies on self-reporting by the states, and all the stigma factors that the other two speakers have mentioned are very much in evidence. So getting any kind of a number is sort of a heroic enterprise. You're always going to be able to criticize them. Net, I think they're doing pretty well, and there's lots of ways they need to do better.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We're going to shift now to discuss the question of government policy, Russia, China, India, and I'd like to ask Judith to sort of start out and ask all of our speakers to really reflect on what is the status of the government's thinking and approach on this epidemic, and what have we learned and been surprised by, what has confirmed sort of operating assumptions that have been around for a long time, what's new and different, where is this likely to be leading looking forward into the future? Judith.
Well, the change in Russia over the last few years has been quite remarkable. Going to Russia as recently as 3 or 4 years ago, we were all beating our heads against the wall trying to get the Russian government to admit that there was any kind of significant HIV epidemic in the country, and certainly to follow up with an allocation of any kinds of resources toward combating the epidemic. Through the early part of this decade, up until 2005, country of about 150 million people, Russia was spending, federal government spending about $4 million a year to combat the epidemic, so an alarmingly low per capita rate of spending there. Around late 2005, early 2006, there was the turning point, and I don't want to say it was an immediate shift. It was a gradual shift that took place over a period of about a year, 18 months, where the Russian government made a transition in the Kremlin at the national level to being one that now vocally discusses the epidemic, acknowledges that a significant epidemic exists, and has increased by 30 or 40 fold the amount of national resources that are being put into the fight against the epidemic. The reasons for the shift, I think, are manyfold. I don't think it's possible to point to just one single factor or one single institution that's responsible for the change in policy. Certainly, Russia's leadership of the G8 in 2006 and the G8 summit in St. Petersburg, with its focus on international health and infectious disease issues, played a major role. Pressure from other national leaders and their discussions with President Putin, pressure from international financial institutions like the World Bank, pressure from within, particularly from a set of very competent and very energetic non-governmental organizations on the ground working in Russia, certainly played a role. And quite frankly, I think it all came down in some senses to just the art of the possible. Russia had the money in 2006 and 2007 that it didn't have back in the late 1990s and the early part of this decade. Russia has become a rich country thanks to its natural resource wealth, and it has become a country that is increasingly anxious to reassert itself as a prominent player on the world stage. The last thing that it wants is to be perceived on that international stage as a source of the problem when it comes to things like HIV/AIDS and infectious disease. It wants to be seen as part of the solution to these problems, and acknowledging its own challenges in that area were an important prerequisite to achieving that kind of part of the solution status. So what's happened in Russia is that they've gone from a situation just a few years ago where there was stonewalling at the federal and regional government level and virtually no resources devoted to the problem, now to one where there's plenty of policy attention to the issue and more money than the country can absorb to spend on the epidemic. And that is the primary challenge that the country faces right now, is building the capacity of the healthcare system, and in this case, building the capacity of the HIV/AIDS treatment centers to absorb all of the money that's coming in from the federal government through the vehicle of a national health project and from the Global Fund. There are currently three active Global Fund projects in Russia as well. Right now, the AIDS centers, those 89 regional AIDS centers, which is where AIDS patients and HIV-infected people get treatment, have more ARVs on the shelves than they know what to do with. They don't have trained staff to administer those ARVs. They don't have good treatment protocols in place. In many cases, the priority of the government toward HIV is such that those AIDS centers now have quotas in place for the numbers of HIV-infected people that they are supposed to have on antiretrovirals, which obviously creates a great many challenges for those folks in the AIDS centers, and quite frankly is leading to situations where they're putting people on medications without the proper counseling, without the proper follow-up. They're in danger of breeding drug-resistant virus because they're not properly administering the ARV. So those capacity building questions at the AIDS centers with the administering of the medications are one of the huge challenges, policy challenges, that the government faces right now. Another problem is that the Russian health system, as remains the case in much of Russian government, is segmented into vertical silos. So the healthcare system writ large is quite separate from the system of HIV care, which is quite separate from the system of care for sexually transmitted infections, which is quite separate from the systems for narcology and treating injection drug users. So if you're worried, for example, about injection drug users as a bridge population that may spread the epidemic through heterosexual contact, at the drug treatment centers, you have absolutely no facility for the drug users to get condoms, receive counseling on sexual health, even receive basic education about prevention of HIV through sexual transmission. So another institutional challenge, policy challenge that the government faces is how to integrate these various elements of addressing the HIV epidemic that have to go into an effective multi-sectoral response. A third challenge that I'll mention is that of prevention. The money that's going into HIV, certainly from the national government and even to some extent from the Global Fund, is going overwhelmingly toward the provision of antiretroviral medications. The very little bit that's going into prevention is going into sort of politically correct mass media campaigns that are targeted primarily at youth writ large. There are alarmingly few prevention messages that are going out to the risk groups that most need to be targeted, so that the vulnerable groups are still not receiving the kinds of prevention messages that have to go along with any kind of effective treatment strategy. And then finally, the fourth policy challenge that I think we should look to down the road in just a couple of years is that of sustainability of all of this current policy attention and funding that's on the table. Both the Global Fund programs and the Russian federal government funding is all done by a project approach, and those projects are all set to run out between 2009 and 2011. And it's unclear what's going to happen after that. Virtually none of the HIV care, the prevention, is integrated in an institutionalized manner into the healthcare system writ large. And therefore, there are significant questions at both the federal and the regional level about the extent to which the current approach is sustainable after the next few years.
Thank you. Let's shift to China, Xiaocheng and Charles. We've seen similar dramatic changes of perspective and there in the last few years. Could you?
Yes. The change in Chinese government's response in the past decade has been dramatic. The first case of HIV/AIDS was identified in China in 1989. Between then and 2003, the Chinese the Chinese authorities were very slow to respond to HIV/AIDS. Since 2003, with the outbreak of SARS, the government response has been significantly expanded. The new administration, led by President Hu Jintao, Premier Wen Jiabao, and Vice Premier Wu Yi, who headed the Ministry of Health during the SARS crisis, has really stepped up the Chinese effort. One good example is the increase in the national budget for HIV/AIDS. The current budget for the most recent data I have for 2006 is $185 million, compared to $100 million in 2005 and $12 million in 2002. The budget is still not as high as the Russian case, but the increase has been dramatic. Over the past 4 years, Beijing has developed some good policies in response to the epidemic. The National Treatment Program was initiated in 2003. The program, with its name China Cares, China Comprehensive AIDS Response is the full term, has the funding through the central government as well as the Global Fund. As of 2006, over 30,000 patients have been treated in all 31 provinces in China through the National Treatment Program. The government has also promoted the policy of four frees and one care. Since 2003, the policy calls for free ARV drugs for rural patients and urban poor population, as well as several other free services and care to people who are financially disadvantaged in China. In 2006, the Chinese government passed its national HIV/AIDS regulation, which was really a long-awaited piece of legislation. the regulation codifies an anti-stigma and anti-discrimination rules. Also, it includes the use of methadone maintenance therapy with the plan to open 1,500 methadone clinics by 2008. Also, very importantly, the Chinese government has become more and more open to international community, both government and non-governmental organizations, such as the Global Fund, the international foundations and corporations, as well as governments of the United States, United Kingdom, Australia, European Union countries, and so forth. As of 2005, the international community has contributed over $229 million to the HIV programs in China. However, there are persistent and serious challenges remaining in the Chinese government's response. To list a few, combating HIV is still seen as a health problem that needs to be tackled by Ministry of Health rather than a broader socioeconomic challenge that requires a comprehensive, coordinated response from across the government agency with the help of non-governmental organizations. Stigma and discrimination still presents as a very persistent obstacle to the successful implementation of HIV programs on the ground. Non-governmental organizations, which have proven to be very effective in reaching out to marginalized groups, still face a constrained operating atmosphere in China. Several other concerns include China's failing healthcare system, lack of resources, particularly in rural China, the safety of China's blood supply, the lack of second-line drugs in China's national program, and also another concern that's becoming serious is with the increased flow of new funding, international funding, and attention to HIV programs in China, there really is a strong need for increased program management expertise within the health system. So in conclusion, the challenge really lies now in translating the good government policy into effective programs on the ground.
Thank you, Charles.
Just to follow up, and Xiaoqing sort of glossed over this, but Teresa says that the failing healthcare system generally, the China's healthcare system is in a state of absolute disrepair. And the unfortunate thing about this is that most of the population that has contracted AIDS really is at the bottom in terms of the priority scale for Chinese government policymakers. So you're really talking about a very, very difficult situation for this population, as our true experts across the room will attest. You know, and when policymakers are going out and they're trying to sort of set healthcare priorities generally for public health, and are forced to sort of get to the point of looking at HIV/AIDS treatment, and you look at an issue like second line treatment, drugs for second line treatment, and they're presented a budget. The Ministry of Health says, okay, here's my budget for second line treatment. That tends to force them to think about the framework for treatment very differently, and they say, here's my budget. Ah, okay, here's how many beds I have to repair for. So this is how many second-line cases I'm going to have. So this is what I'm estimating. And that changes the entire focus. So, I mean, it's counterintuitive, but that's what's going on.
Thank you. Tessie and Vibhuti?
I think there's one important contrast between India and the two programs you've just heard from. Indian government policy, at least at the level of what it's trying to do, is largely a story of continuity. Vibhuti already talked about the notable increase in energy, which is very welcome. And she's going to talk about some of the other things that she observed. The other thing that actually is quite similar to what you heard is the tension between integrating HIV/AIDS policy with the rest of health and the stovepiped program. And one of the interesting things is that the HIV/AIDS specialists all prefer the stovepiped approach because then they know what they've got. They'd like everybody else to put money into it, but they want their own program. the people above that level who are worried about national health policy are desperate to find greater integration because they see all of these other massive problems out there that they're going to have difficulty dealing with.
That's exactly true. I think one of the concerns that was raised was that with decentralization being one of the main emphases of the National AIDS Control Program, the new phase, NACP3, there's going to be an enormous amount of pressure on the central government in the short to medium term to provide capacity building support at the district and sub-district level. But I think overall there's a general feeling that decentralization is a good idea because after all, India does not have one epidemic. There's a great deal of variation between states and within states. I think everyone hopes that decentralization will not only make local groups more accountable, but it will give the government the flexibility it needs to have a more nuanced approach to the epidemic. Overall, decentralization is a step in the right direction because essentially making decentralization the main emphasis of NACP3 is the national program acknowledging that there cannot be a cookie-cutter approach to the epidemic. The second idea that emerged was information sharing, and this is in line with what Judith talked about with vertical silos. I think the basic motivation behind the idea of information sharing is that although there are clear vertical lines, there is no horizontal connection, and that perhaps if states are talking to each other, that will give the government an edge to get ahead of the curve. The basic idea was that it would be really useful to have some kind of interstate network where counterparts in each state and decision makers were talking to each other on a regular basis. So there were a bunch of ideas thrown around, including having newsletters or a national forum where different stakeholders, state and health agency officials, can get together and discuss, share lessons learned, successes, what has worked, what hasn't. Tamil Nadu has been doing some really good work. Andhra Pradesh, AP, would benefit greatly from talking to their counterparts in Tamil Nadu. That kind of thing needs to happen more. Essentially getting synergy at the state level that will facilitate sharing of resources, whether that's data sharing or sharing or transfer of human resources. So those are the two issues.
Thank you.
The other point of evolution in the national government policy is that now, compared to 5 years ago, there is a much greater emphasis on treatment. The treatment program, which was started 4 years ago, has moved quite slowly. At least on paper, the plan is to accelerate it and to start moving into second-line treatment.
I'm going to go ahead and move our speakers to the last question before we open for comment and question at the conclusion so that we don't run out of time. This brings us really to the question of what should be the priorities of the U.S. government today and looking forward to the next administration in its bilateral engagement with these three terribly important governments on the question of HIV control. What has happened up to now? What have we learned? And how do our authors really see this in terms of the bilateral relationship? It's less clear because these countries are in their own right so capable. It's less clear in that these are countries that do not have raging generalized epidemics. They do not fall within the focus priority countries, but they remain terribly important at a global level, and they may remain terribly important to our U.S. foreign policy interests with respect to transnational disease. I'm going to turn to Judith to kick this part off, and we will come to questions in a moment.
The United States has been very productively engaged with Russia on HIV and health issues for quite some years, and in an approach that's been pretty smart, if I can insert a value judgment there, especially over the last few years. USAID has observed, rightly, and now under the PEPFAR umbrella, has continued to observe that we don't have the money to be working across all of Russia's 11 time zones. We also don't have the money to be engaged in the provision of antiretroviral medications. And so what USAID has done is focus primarily on two regions in Russia and focus on activities there that I think really are designed to have a demonstration approach to the rest of the country and to the Russian government, so that there has been a tremendous focus in those two regions on USAID's activity in reaching out to vulnerable groups, in trying to craft prevention messages that are targeted appropriately and constructed appropriately for the Russian social context. so that it's been a strategy that has I think, been quite cleverly crafted and quite effective over the last couple of years. Now, the informal discussion in the people in the U.S. government is that it's likely that within the next, say, 4 or 5 years, USAID may leave the health tableau in Russia. The argument being that over the next 5 years, particularly now that Russia has all of its own money going into HIV, that USAID will either have made a difference or not at that point, and that it will be logical to be gone at that point. And I'll argue that that is a dangerous line of thinking, because all of the money in the world doesn't guarantee, as I've implied earlier, that you have the capacity to spend that money effectively. And there's a very important continued role for the United States government and for other donors to maintain a presence to make sure that these significant amount of resources that are devoted to the problem in Russia are not thrown down the drain. In particular, I can point to just some issue areas where I think it's particularly important that that demonstration effect continue. Russia has very little tradition of evidence-based medicine, and the kind of partnerships between physicians and between institutions country to country, not only with respect to HIV, but with health and medicine and research writ large, I think is critically important. And there's a new generation of Russian scientists that's now beginning to do some very important work in epidemiology of infectious disease, of addiction disease. Those scientists were virtually all trained and brought into an evidence-based medicine and evidence-based research tradition through their partnership with American and other Western scientists. It's critically important that that cadre of Russian scientists and physicians continue to be supported. I've also already mentioned the HIV prevention messages, a critically important area in which there's much that USAID and other Western partners can do to help Russia get on the right track in terms of spending its resources in that area. It was mentioned a few minutes ago that China is getting into the game of substitution therapy. Substitution therapy is still illegal in Russia. And so it's very difficult for an injection drug user who wants to stop using drugs to find the resources to do that effectively in Russia. This is certainly an area where the United States can make persuasive arguments about what has worked in terms of international experience and experience here in the United States. And then finally, I would argue that the United States can play a role in broadening the conversation on health issues in Russia beyond just HIV and beyond tuberculosis and some other infectious diseases to point to non-communicable disease and injury, which has become part of the conversation in Russia in conjunction with its international partners over the last year or two. It's non-communicable disease and injury that is still driving the Russian demographic crisis today, and the United States government presence there can make sure that the health conversation doesn't remain siloed or limited just to HIV/AIDS, but that HIV/AIDS becomes part of a much broader conversation about the health challenges facing the country.
Thank you, Judith. Andrew?
Let me just build on the last point that Judy was made, both to justify my name tag being up here and to hopefully add a little bit of value in context to our conversation. Because I think the collaboration that has developed over the years between the United States and the Russian Federation in dealing with the HIV/AIDS problem really sets an important and useful precedent and basis for much broader healthcare cooperation and in addressing the very serious problems that the Russian Federation faces. I mean, just the demographic crisis. I mean, we're still looking at a population where the death rate is exceeding the birth rate at approximately 700,000 per year, where the average life expectancy for men is somewhere in the age of 60, 61 years, dramatically low, virtually the only quasi-industrialized emerging market country in the world, which in the last 40 years the life expectancy for has dropped by a considerable margin. That's pretty remarkable. These are big problems the Russian Federation faces in the future. Judy is quite right that the Russian government does have far more economic resources to apply to them. But if we look at the experience, the Soviet experience, the Soviet health system, and the existing Russian health system right now, it doesn't leave us with a tremendous amount of confidence, us or I think Russian officials themselves, that those funds can be spent effectively. And the last point I would make is to put this in the context of the U.S.-Russian relationship. It's not exactly a big secret that the U.S.-Russian relationship has been deteriorating over the course of the last number of years quite seriously. And we see it very dramatically, actually, in the parliamentary election campaigns. The elections are taking place on Sunday, in which case Mr. Putin and his colleagues in the Kremlin have, in effect, made this a campaign against the West, particularly against the United States, and against the United States, which is supposedly trying to weaken Russia, and one of the threats that Russia faces. And this has been a building, line of rhetoric from the Kremlin over the course of the last few years. And, you know, this is an area where we can work together, and I think where it is beyond a shadow of a doubt that we are not trying to weaken Russia, and where there can be some really valuable contributions both for the for Russian health, possibly also with scientific cooperation that goes on between Russian and American scientists for broader global health issues. And finally, the thing that I spend most of my time worrying about, that is the U.S.-Russian relationship. So,
thank you. Thank you, Andy. Charles, would you like to kick off the discussion on China?
Okay. I'll start with the overview picture of what the U.S. government has been assisting in China. The U.S. government has been actively funding HIV programs in China, both bilaterally and through multilateral organizations. The U.S. government's contribution to the Global Fund, which accounts for one-third of the Global Fund's total funding, and the Global Fund has been very active in China. Bilaterally, the U.S. government programs are implemented through USAID and HHS, U.S. CDC's Global AIDS Program, the GAP Program, NIH, and Department of Labor. Since 2006, all U.S. government bilateral programs in China have been integrated into the PEPFAR umbrella in order to facilitate better coordination and management. Under PEPFAR, China received over nearly $10 million U.S. dollar from the U.S. government in 2006, and the funding for 07 and 08 is pledged to remain at a similar level. All U.S. government-funded programs in China are in support and consistent with the Chinese national and local HIV strategy. I think one thing that the U.S. government programs has been doing very well is to play the different implementation agencies' comparative advantage. The HHS and the U.S. CDC's program is the China GAP program was established in 2003. And the HHS and the CDC's effort is leading the U.S. government efforts in China, as opposed to, this is an interesting trend because in most other countries, it's the USAID that is taking the lead. However, in China, it's more the CDC, the GAP program, which has been very successful. NIH awarded a $14 million five-year grant to China CDC under its CIPRA program. This is a research grant to expand China's capacity comprehensive HIV AIDS treatment and prevention research. I want to emphasize the importance of this research project and its popularity among the Chinese medical researchers. They really appreciate the funding from NIH to conduct research exchange. The USAID funding for HIV programs in China concentrates on HIV prevention targeting high-risk groups in the Mekong provinces of Yunnan and Guangxi. Since USAID does not have an office in China, its support is channeled through its regional development mission in Asia and its greater Mekong regional HIV AIDS strategy. The Department of Labor also is another implementational agency. In January 2007, the Department of Labor funded a three-year education campaign in China aiming at the migrant workers to improve HIV/AIDS awareness and to reduce discrimination among migrant workers and their families. The U.S. assistance provides...
Cha-ching. I think we need to skip to sort of what, where does this fit within the broad bilateral relationship, and what's the future likely to look like? I think everybody can read the report as far as all of the specifics.
Oh, it's good stuff, though.
It's good stuff.
Yeah, no,
come on,
it's very good stuff. You've done a great job, but we need to sort of cut to the chase.
Cut to the chase. I mean, essentially, for those of us that care about the overall sort of maintenance of the bilateral relationship, I think this is one of the few areas where we have direct common interest and share common interest, and it's one of the few areas where we actually do some stuff together that's productive and positive. We have the U.S.-China bilateral agenda maybe it's not as collapsing as rapidly as the U.S.-Russia relationship, but it's got a lot of thorns to it, particularly on the economic side. And this is one of the areas where we actually have a lot of common interest and share a lot of common agenda. We do a lot of good there, and there are a couple of dangers. A, the notion that we're giving any money to China, even in an area like this, strikes a lot of people in Congress as crazy, given that China has an enormous trade deficit or trade surplus with the United States. So that the notion that we're actually aiding China, even if it's an area of goodwill, makes them a little bit creeped out. And the other side of the equation that I think we need to be concerned about is compulsory licensing of pharmaceuticals in this area. China, unlike some of the other countries in the region, has not yet openly begun talking about the possibility of compulsory licensing of pharmaceuticals in this area. And I'm not arguing that it's a bad policy or good policy. I'm just suggesting that once a country starts going down the road of compulsory licensing, that changes the political dynamic between the United States and that country tremendously. And the chance that China will go down the route of compulsory licensing, given its tremendous needs, particularly for second-line treatment, I believe, is very strong. And if that happens, there will be this will not be a particular area of common interest between the United States and China.
Thank you. Tessie?
The United States as a country is still the largest external contributor to India's HIV/AIDS program. But much of this comes not from the U.S. government, but from foundations, NGOs, and other actors. The U.S. government's annual contribution is on the order of $30 billion, which makes India the largest recipient of PEPFAR funds other than the focus countries. But this is a number that has not changed significantly in the past several years, and it's substantial. They're asking for FY 2008 substantially the same as for 2007. This is an underfunded effort in India. It's underfunded in general, and it's also underfunded by the government of India. Much of the money that is spent on it is, in fact, contributed from the outside. I think that countries tend to take more seriously campaigns in which they have a somewhat larger percentage of their own funds invested, so I think this is important. The second, two other points. First, Chao-Ching made the point that collaborative research with China has been a big, an attractive feature of our involvement. That is certainly true of India and has been for years. India is still one of the major participants in the National Institutes of Health international research projects under the Fogarty Center. And these have two huge advantages. They connect the large and talented Indian research establishment to world-class work that's going on HIV/AIDS with value flowing in both directions. Second, this is an area where India and the United States, or Indians and Americans, are working as equals. That brings you to how this relates to the broader India-U.S. relationship. And in contrast to Russia and China, on India, the relationship with the United States is going up. It will never be problem-free. But basically, the trend has been towards much closer relations, much more meaningful interaction politically in every other way. One of the critical ingredients in this is to establish a relationship among equals in as many areas as that is feasible. This is something that the U.S. hasn't always had an easy time doing. I like to think of the health area as an area where this might be easier to do. The other important element in the funding and the implementation of India's aid policy, which I think is very important for the connection with the U.S., is the linkages to public health and to development. A big study came out in India about 8 months ago, which attempted to estimate the impact of the AIDS epidemic on India's economic growth. And they came up with an estimate that the epidemic cost India something over 1 percentage point a year in GDP growth. That doesn't sound like a whole lot, especially for a country that's growing at about 9% a year. But for a country that sees itself on the cusp of great things, this is actually a very heavy price to pay. So I would argue that the linkage to public health and to development is important for the sustainability of this effort, and also for the larger question of how India plays in the global game, which is becoming increasingly important.
Thank you. Thank you. It's interesting that, and Judith, I'll come to you in just a moment. It's interesting that across these three cases, this remains a zone of strong cooperation and promise for better cooperation, with lots of hazard signs out there as well, of the kind that each of you have highlighted. The TB, the XDR, MDR, TB issue, particularly in the and the drug addiction dimension, particularly with respect to China and Russia, these are two looming big issues that tie in directly to the HIV piece, tie directly into sort of U.S. engagement in all three. So we have just a few minutes left. We'd like to invite a few comments and questions from the audience. We'll come back and wrap up. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for the presentation. CSIS is in a really good position to make linkages that often are not made. And in listening to the presentations and thinking, especially on this last part, one of the things we think we know about the AIDS epidemic is that political leadership matters, that a multi-sectoral approach is vital. And yet, what most of the U.S. response as it's been described has been technical and medical. CSIS has done work on PEPFAR reauthorization. And I'm wondering a couple of things. Whether one of the issues in PEPFAR is that with its creation and the creation of OGAP, the Department of State has in some ways been let off the hook. It was doing, I think, and I have a vested interest in it, or had, some really good work in doing diplomatic outreach, doing political outreach at the leadership level. Is that still going on? Is there a place, Tazi, I appreciate and agree with you that sometimes health is an easier, less contentious area to build relationships. And I'm wondering if this is something as we move ahead with PEPFAR that has to be considered in how we rebuild in a diplomatic outreach on the issue of AIDS.
Okay, let's take, if there are other comments or questions. Yes, and then please identify yourself.
Yes, I'm Kim Tumanaro from the Department of State Russia Desk. In answer to your question, I know that at least in the Russian PEPFAR program, there is a significant amount of resources. There are a significant amount of resources devoted to that political level outreach. Whether it's going to get us anything or not, I don't know. But we do work very closely with UNAIDS and the government and, you know, the embassy to develop these messages and to get the policy level messages out. That kind of led me to my other comment, too, is that this is still another reason for why we need continued engagement with Russia on HIV/AIDS. And, you know, just the policy debate within Russia itself, I mean, these messages from Onyshenko, which contrasted with the Federal AIDS Research Center, shows that there's still not a real consensus here that, you know, there's a significant problem or the ways to deal with the problem. So our involvement is still vital. Thank you.
Yes.
I'm Paul Jensen from Result Educational Fund, and my question was actually about the TB issue. on the TB-HIV issue and implications for government policy. And we know that TB is the leading cause of death for people with AIDS, and all three of these countries are high TB burden countries. But the only paper I saw that really addressed it was the Russia paper. Now, I don't know how to the extent to which the epidemics have really converged in Russia, but I know TB is a leading infectious cause of death in the country, and that doesn't really bode well for the future of the AIDS epidemic. And I know it's increasingly a problem in India. They don't have a TB-HIV national policy. So do you have any comments about, you know, implications for government policy?
We have, is there one last, Harley?
Sure, I just wanted to ask, one of the common themes across, excuse me, across all three countries is that prevalence of high HIV prevalence populations among minority groups in border areas, along heroin trafficking routes, which in some cases, like Manipur, Nagaland, in India, and Xinjiang, and I don't know really if Chechnya fits this well or not, but you know, of low-level insurgency activity. I'm just wondering what comments, since these are high HIV prevalence areas in each of the countries, what sort of your thoughts are on government response to those particularly complex areas.
Okay. Come back to our speakers to wrap up, and we'll start down at that end with Chao Cheng and Charles, and just roll this way.
Okay. I mean, with respect to what they've done in border areas, China's done in border areas, they've done an awful lot, frankly, militarily down in the south, in terms of trying to deal with the drug trafficking and drug trade. They've been they seem to have adopted our policy of preemption, moving into the southern countries along the border and actually taking out production and traffickers, as well as doing a lot of other stuff. So they've been very aggressive.
Can you comment on the TB piece?
Is TB a major cause of? Yeah, absolutely. And it is. TB is, I think, is it number one or number two as a government health care priority in China now?
Number one.
The intersection.
The siloing of the different national programs. I mean, how, to what extent are TB and HIV programs working together?
I can't answer that question. I have a gut, and it's probably negative, not very well.
And I think the TB question falls back to the overall healthcare capacity building program question again in China, and I think this is what the government is becoming aware of, and I think they are at the stage of figuring out a more comprehensive healthcare capacity building approach. And back to the diplomatic outreach question, I also want to mention that the strategic economic dialogue between U.S. and China, the health is part of the agenda, and the bilateral cooperation on HIV/AIDS, on bird flu, and other issues, it is a point of discussion. So I think it's a promising area.
First, on diplomatic and political leadership, Judith, I actually think that the U.S. government has done pretty well in this department. There were a couple of opportunities where I thought we might have raised the profile a bit, but you've got an ambassador that takes the issue very seriously and that finds occasions to give it publicity. You have in the prime minister a guy whose sort of training as an economist leads him to take these things very seriously. He's a rather gentle soul, and he has occasionally made high-profile interventions, but not very often, and I think this is more temperamental than anything else. Tuberculosis is a hideous problem in India. It's also the area of one of their greatest successes, at least in operational terms, in health infrastructure. Their DOTS program, directly observed training regimen, is considered to be a model in terms of actually getting treatment out to the people who need it. The HIV people have been trying for years to piggyback onto that and to at least get some, you know, some posters up, some messages out, and the DOTS people are keeping them at arm's length. Our old friend stigma is back. They're afraid that they will suffer by being stigmatized if they breathe the word HIV in the presence of a TB clinic. This is a real problem. This is probably the biggest challenge of integration, even more so than bureaucratic inertia, which should not be underestimated. Finally, border areas. There are two border areas between India and its neighbors that are significant from the HIV/AIDS point of view. The first are the two tiny northeastern states where the epidemic is largely drug-driven. These are areas of chronic insurgency. They're ethnically distinct from the rest of India and distinct from one another. There are seven different, very small, ethnically based states up there. In principle, India is working very hard on the insurgency. They've certainly got programs up there. I don't think it's going to get a whole lot better anytime soon. The other, which is in a way more troublesome, is in both Uttar Pradesh and Bihar, two very large population states along the border with Nepal. Notoriously porous border. Nepal has been in various stages of political meltdown for the past 2 or 3 years, which aggravates the problem. And they have now, in this latest batch of numbers, actually measured distressingly high prevalence of HIV/AIDS in the Uttar Pradesh districts that border on Nepal. I will bet you money that the same thing exists in Bihar, which is the worst governed state in the country. What I'm telling you is that people are now aware of the problem and that these are among the hardest areas in all of India to do something effective about it.
Thank you. Last call here on the three issues that are on the table.
In terms of further comment about the possibility of health being used as an entree into broader diplomatic fence mending between the United States and Russia, certainly there's enormous potential there, and much has been done. I would just insert a word of caution that this has to be done carefully because of the sensitivity of the Russians and the Russian government to this issue. Russians view their health and demographic crisis as a national security crisis. The word genocide of the Russian people has been thrown around in Russian circles to refer to the collapse in population over the last the decade and a half, so that it certainly there is an approach that can be taken in this area, but it's one that has to be done very carefully, I think, and with a great deal of respect for the Russian vantage point on the situation. In terms of tuberculosis, as you probably know, the Russian approach to tuberculosis is one that involves surgical treatment and long inpatient stays. And Russia has had to be sort of dragged kicking and screaming into the modern era in terms of DOTS and global best practices approach to tuberculosis. Very much the systems for tuberculosis treatment are still vertically isolated, separate from those for HIV. I think about a year ago they created a coordinating commission at the governmental level for TB, HIV co-infection, and it's met once at most, I think. So it's just not something that has any traction. I think it's important, though, to point out that not only tuberculosis co-infection, but hepatitis co-infection is a big deal in Russia right now, and it's something that is the wave of the future in terms of the linkages with other infectious disease. And we're also starting to see the beginnings of some research being published now on alcohol and alcohol abuse and its relationship to the tuberculosis, hepatitis, and HIV epidemics. Clearly, these are all part of the same larger picture that remains dramatically understudied. On the question about the government response to drug trafficking in the border areas, not just in Chechnya and border areas, but nationwide over the last couple of years, there's been an even harsher crackdown on drug trafficking and drug use than very aggressive law enforcement approach and a lot of boastful press releases from the state drug control agency about how many people they've arrested in prison, that sort of thing. And I'll just comment once again that in terms of the relationship of that law enforcement approach to drug use to the HIV epidemic, there's an incredibly negative impact on the capacity of harm reduction programs to function effectively, and that's where I see the most important observation.
Can you just, on that, was one last comment, can you tell, speak to the whole issue of the expansion of production, heroin production out of Afghanistan coming through Russia, and what that has meant in terms of the drug-addicted population and the HIV piece of that?
It's been important, and obviously Russia is one of the main trafficking routes, you know, up through Central Asia and Russia and into the markets in Western Europe. So there's no question that that's an important factor, although it's, I think, interesting also to observe that one of the reasons that's commonly cited for the decline in officially reported annual incidence of HIV in the early part of this decade is that heroin and other injection drugs have sort of fallen out of favor, and that the more, you know, sort of fashionable drugs that the young people are using now are methamphetamines, other non-injection drugs. Now, that's true primarily among users in the urban areas, and I suspect that we don't have a good handle on what's happening in the rural areas where those trends tend to lag the urban areas by a few years. But in terms of usage patterns, there's been a shift away from heroin in the last couple of years.
Andy, you want to close?
Well, I think the concern about the Russian government about the increase in heroin production and transport out of Afghanistan, particularly in the last few years, is very, very, very real. And of course, you know, the Russians shared our interests in taking out the Taliban six years ago. They're very much with us, and this drug trafficking issue is one of which is very, very high on their concern list, in which there is cooperation going on between us, and I think that we could probably do more there.
Well, we're at the end of our time. I want to thank everyone who's come and been with us through this period, and I particularly want to thank the authors and speakers that we have here today for all of your efforts, for being with us today, and for putting together three really terrific papers. So on behalf of everyone here, please join me.